So, any questions? So, you guys are all random field professionals now. Let me ask you a few questions. A random field in 3D, say, has a 2-point correlation function which can be written like this in real space, where zeta parameterizes the 2-point correlation and is called the correlation function, or like this in Fourier space, where P of K is parameterizes the power spectrum. And in both cases, a single function of one real variable parameterizes the 2-point function. What would happen? This was under the assumption of two symmetries, translation invariance and rotation invariance. So what would happen if I assume translation invariance only? So there's no preferred point, but the rotation invariance is broken, so there can be preferred directions. Then how would the right-hand sides change?
First, we will have a function out of the modulus of x minus y, but just x minus y.
Yeah, so this one's easy. So that this just means this one's really intuitive. The correlation between 2 points depends on their vector separation, not their scalar separation. So this is a function of three variables or one vector. How about this one? Yeah, basically the same thing. This guy just gets a vector. So it's also a function of three variables. The delta function here is capturing the translation invariance. And the argument for that delta function was that if I translated by some displacement tau, that these guys would phase by e to the ik tau, ik dot tau star, e to the ik prime dot tau. And the only way that can leave the, in other words, the total phase applied is k minus k prime dot tau. And the only way that can leave the 2-point function invariant is if there's a delta function k minus k prime here. So generally speaking, this wave number conserving or momentum conserving delta function is capturing the translation invariance. Now what would happen if I had two functions, say phi is a, instead of a scalar valued function phi of x, I had a, say, a two component thing with no additional symmetry assumptions. Like, I'm not assuming an internal symmetry that relates the one, two indices here. Then how would these, let me go back to assuming full symmetry. So I'll translation plus rotation invariance. Okay, so let's say that I had some indices here on the left-hand side. Then what would happen on the right-hand side? How would I parameterize the most general 2-point correlation function allowed by symmetries? This is sort of less profound than it sounds. You just have the correlation function is now a matrix valued function of one real variable, and likewise for the power spectrum. Now, you might think that the correlation function at some separation S, would be a general real matrix. I'm not assuming like any symmetries relating the one and the two indices. So there's no relation between these functions. So you might think that for every separation, there are four functions that I need to specify. However, just for fun, so there's sort of a non-obvious thing that's true here. Can anyone think of what I said isn't quite true, that there are four independent functions here. Can anyone think of a relation between these? In fact, it's always true that zeta 2, 1 is zeta 1, 2. This is always a symmetric matrix. The reason is sort of non-obvious. So if I exchange the labels here, then I'm exchanging the order that I write these functions in the product doesn't matter, of course. But if I exchange the labels, I also have to exchange x and y. And then it's also true that if I exchange x for y, I can't change the correlation function because that just changes the displacement to its negative. And I can do that with a rotation, with a 180-degree rotation. I'm assuming rotation symmetry. So under the assumption of rotation invariance, this is actually a 3x3 symmetric matrix. For the power spectrum, it is also true, and I'll let you think about working out the details of this argument, that Pij is a symmetric real matrix. So it also depends. There are also three independent functions. This subject, you sort of have to become a human dictionary of little one-line identities like this that are not hard. There's just a lot of them. So let's say I like this quiz format, so I'm going to do a few more. Let's say I have a Gaussian random field phi with some power spectrum P of k. I want to talk about a particular calculation that you might be interested in, which is that, let's say this is a Gaussian random field in 2D, which is that I have n points chosen in advance. They're not random or anything. And I'm interested in, I measure phi at each of those points. And I'm interested in this case in the 5x5 covariance matrix of these observations. So there's some covariance matrix Cij, which is, maybe I'm interested in simulating a random realization, but I only want it at these 5 points. I don't want to simulate it everywhere and then restrict the values. So I'll just work out the 5x5 covariance matrix and draw a random Gaussian with that covariance matrix. The first thing I want to say is that these random variables, this 5-tuple of random variables, I want to ask the question, is it true that this is a multivariate Gaussian random variable in the sense that we defined in class? If phi is a if the continuous function phi is a Gaussian random field, is it true or false that these 5 numbers are a 5-component multivariate Gaussian random variable?
That would be possible if we could diagonalize the correlation matrix.
You're thinking ahead a little bit. That's the question of how you would simulate or just generally simplify this 5-component object. You could always rotate, apply a 5-dimensional rotation to remove the correlations, make the off-diagonal correlation 0. When I ask whether it's Gaussian, Gaussian means that the covariance matrix is all you need to know to capture all of the statistics of those 5 numbers. All the higher point expectation values are determined by Wick's theorem, for example. So this is true. This is not so obvious. Like a Gaussian random field, one way to think about it, or the way that I think about it, is it's a bunch of Gaussian random numbers in Fourier space that you take the Fourier transform of. Why should the output of that Fourier transform of Gaussian random numbers also be a bunch of Gaussian numbers? And this is because linear combinations of Gaussians are Gaussian. You know, one way, these five numbers are just complicated linear combinations defined by Fourier transform of the original Gaussian random numbers in Fourier space. Or a more abstract way of saying it is that I just have some Gaussian random field. Any linear operator that I apply to that Gaussian random field gives a Gaussian random thing. Like Gaussian randomness is something that is independent of the basis and preserved by linear operations. And in particular, the linear operation can take a field from in one number of dimensions to a field in some other number of dimensions. As in this case, we're going from two dimensions to zero dimensions by just restricting to some finite collection of points. If we wanted to simulate these five numbers, for example, the covariance matrix would be enough. Let's talk about how you might compute it. How would you compute, if I give you the power spectrum P of K, how would you go about computing this 5x5 matrix? Well, let's say it was a 1x1 matrix. Let's say you just wanted, in this case, the 1x1 covariance matrix is just the variance of phi of x1 or phi of x1 squared. How would you compute this given the power spectrum? Sorry? Oh, okay, cool. So I take the Fourier transform. To get the correlation function. And then what would I do? If I just want one number here. This is just a fixed point, and I'm asking if I take a random realization of the field, of the random field. What's that? Well, so let's see. This is a, remember the correlation function is a function of a separation mm-hmm. between two points. And here I just have one point. When we're writing the correlation, think about the correlation function. Let me denote the separation S. Is that it's the correlation between phi of x and phi of x plus s. Field values at any two points with displacement s. Here I just have the same point, just evaluated zero. What would you do if you had two points? And you want to fill in, in the one-point case, the covariance matrix, the matrix in quotes, is just a 1x1 matrix. What would you do if you had two points and I wanted to compute all four entries of the covariance matrix? Well, this one is, the correlation function always gives the expectation value of the product of two field values with some displacement. So I just evaluate at the displacement between the two points. In general, that's what you do. So the covariance matrix is asking for the 2-point function of two phi values, you know, at some fixed separation. And you always compute that by just evaluating the correlation function at an appropriate argument at the length of the separation vector. So one way of filling in this 5x5 matrix would be I Fourier transform P to get the correlation function, and then I evaluate the correlation function at all the separations to fill in all the entries of the matrix. Some of the problems in the tutorial were sort of, you know, higher dimensional versions of this, like what happens if you, here we're taking a Gaussian random field and restricting it to a few points. You might ask, what happens if we take a Gaussian random field in 3D and restrict it to a plane to get a Gaussian random field in 2D, for example? Okay. So, I want to talk about, so I have a little more to say about Gaussian random fields. I want to say a little bit about, so far we've been talking about Gaussian random fields on like a 2D plane or a 3D volume. But in cosmology, we often encounter Gaussian random fields that live on a 2D sphere for a random field on a 2D sphere. For example, the cosmic microwave background temperature, T. I usually write fields on a sphere as a function of a unit vector n. I put some thought into how much to say about this, because fully working out the spherical analogs of all of the flat results we've derived so far involves like a really surprisingly large number of special functions and obscure looking identities relating them. And if you want to do like write papers in cosmology, then at some point you have to sit down and spend like a week learning all of these special functions and how they're related to each other. And it's not hard, but it's a poor use of time in a 3-week class. So I'm going to say as little as possible, just so it doesn't seem like I'm making some sort of, you know, fuzzy, ill-defined leap from flat results to spherical results. So I want to write down like a little dictionary between random fields on a 2D plane and random fields on a 2D sphere. So just for example, the correlation function. The 2D plane, we had this result that said that under the assumption of full symmetry, the translation and rotation symmetry of the 2D plane, the correlation function was the 2-point function was a function of the length of the separation vector, and that defines the correlate. That's the most general 2-point function allowed by symmetry, and it defines the correlation function zeta. And on the sphere, the generalization is kind of obvious. It just says that if I have the CMB temperature at two directions, say, that its 2-point function only depends on the angle between the two. This is just the angle on the sphere between the two vectors, or if you want the inverse cosine of their dot product, just to write down a formal definition. So that's easy and intuitive. The Fourier transform. So the Fourier transform on a plane says that every function of x of position is a linear combination of plane waves, where the Fourier transform T tilde of L just gives the coefficient of the plane wave with wave number L. And the analog of this on the sphere is the spherical harmonic transform, which says that any function on the sphere is a sum of spherical harmonics. So this is an invertible transform. It's invertible in the sense that you can go back and forth between a function on the sphere, a scalar value function on the sphere, and this set of coefficients ALM, the multipole coefficients, by means of this invertible spherical harmonic transform. So one thing that happens on the sphere is that wave numbers are quantized. The wave number L can only take integer values between 0 and infinity. That happens in general whenever you have some sort of compact geometry. Like, for example, if I take the case of a 1D line, an infinite 1D line, then any Fourier mode, any sinusoid e to the I omega t is well defined. But if I make the this periodic by wrapping it on itself, so if I impose a periodicity with some length L, or consider a circle of circumference or of radius L over 2 pi, then the only allowed wave numbers are integer multiples of 2 pi over L. Otherwise, the periodicity wouldn't be satisfied. So wave numbers are quantized as an integer multiples of 2 pi over L. Likewise, on the sphere, the only allowed wave numbers are integers. But for every integer, there's a degeneracy in that there are a bunch of YLMs with the same wave number. There is a YLM for every integer m between minus L and L. So there's one monopole mode, L equals 0 mode, Y00, which is a constant function. And there are three L equals 1 modes, three dipole modes, which correspond to the three coordinate directions and so on. Now, I'm not really going to use much about this expansion, but one thing that will be really important is just the statement that there are two L plus one modes for at wave number L. The counting of modes will be important for what we're going to do. In the flat case, there was this so-called reality condition, which is just a way of taking the statement that the field is real valued in real space and translating that into Fourier space. We showed that if t star equals t in real space, then t star is t of minus L in Fourier space. The analog of that in the flat sky is this. In order to prove that, we would have to just start going down the rabbit hole of deriving identities for special functions. This actually derives from an identity that's a corresponding identity for the spherical harmonics themselves, which says that YLM star is minus 1 to the M YL minus M. The only reason I'm writing it down is because it affects the counting of modes or the counting of degrees of freedom. This identity shows that for every L, the coefficient AL0 is a real number. And the higher m's, m greater than or equal to 1, are complex numbers. And the negative m's are just related to the positive m's by this identity. So if you wanted to calculate the number of real numbers that you need to specify at multiple L, the count is 2L plus 1, because you have AL0, which is a real number, and then you have AL1 through ALL, which are complex, two real numbers each. That fact will turn out to be important in a little bit. The power spectrum. So we showed that in flat space, this should be an L prime, that the two-point function is diagonal in Fourier space. There are no correlations allowed between different L's. And the coefficient sitting in front of this delta function can depend on L, and is defined to be the power spectrum. Let me write it C of L. The analogous statement, and this is actually not so easy to prove. This is going moderately far down the special function rabbit hole. You can ask, what is the most general two-point correlation function between in harmonic space, which remember means between ALMs? So with no symmetry assumptions, you know, this would just be some arbitrary function of with four indices here on the right-hand side. But if you ask, what's the most general form that's allowed by full symmetry, that is to say the three-dimensional rotation symmetry of the sphere, then the result has a certain analogy with a certain similarity with the flat case. So there are delta functions in both L and M. So each multipole ALM is only allowed to correlate with itself, and each ALM is an independent Gaussian random quantity. The coefficient sitting in front can depend on L, but not M. That's like loosely analogous to the statement here that the power spectrum depends on the length of L, but not its direction. This is the definition of the power spectrum this is the definition of CL. I mean, it's more than a definition, because there's also the theorem that this form with the delta functions and no M index on the C is the most general two-point function allowed by symmetry. This is also the definition of CL, and this is like the famous CL that you see in all the plots, like when the CMB power spectrum is plotted. On the sphere, the power spectrum is only defined at integer values of L. In contrast to the flat case where L is a continuous number. That's just life in a compact geometry. Wave numbers are quantized. When we compute this power spectrum CL, like there are these monster codes that compute it for a given set of cosmological parameters, it spits out a set of numbers, C2, C3, C4, and so on. That's not like the code isn't choosing to just sample at integer values of L and let you interpolate in between. The power spectrum is just only defined at integer values, and there's nothing in between. Now would be a good time to mention that we think of the CMB power spectrum as starting at L equals 2, starting at the quadrupole. Now C0, and here's why that's true. The monopole of the CMB is just its sky average, or the mean temperature, 2.726 Kelvin. We could say this is A00 if we wanted to. There's a factor of square root 4 pi relating the sky average and A00, but who's counting? This number, the monopole of T, contains a lot of information. It basically contains one cosmological parameter. If you like, it's the radiation, omega radiation times h squared, physical radiation density. This is something you showed in the tutorial. And it's much larger than the other multipoles, like the other ALMs are of order, say 100 micro K or smaller. So it's there, and it contains a lot of information. We just treat it separately because it's telling us one cosmological parameter related to the background. It's not telling us anything about the fluctuations. The L equals 1 modes are also there. They are a few millikelvin of order, say, 3 millikelvin. And in principle, some fraction of this 3 millikelvin, about 1%, are temperature fluctuations on the last scattering surface, the dipole part of those fluctuations. But added to those is our motion, the relative motion of the Earth relative to the surface of last scattering, or relative to the FRW rest frame, another way of putting it. The Doppler shifts the CMB. So if I'm moving by 10 to the minus 3 C, in a uniform CMB, then there's a Doppler shift that makes the CMB look hotter in this direction, colder in this direction, by 1 part in 10 to the 3, that Doppler shift. And that's 99% of these dipole modes. We normally don't really pay much attention to these because they're just telling us, they're not telling us anything, they're there, but they don't tell us anything about cosmology. They tell us about an accident of history, how our Earth ended up having the velocity that it has. And then the higher modes are, so this is like, these are just the motion of the Earth. At least 99% of them is the motion of the Earth. And the higher modes, A2M for L greater than or equal to 2, are cosmological fluctuations. These really are fluctuations in the plasma at a redshift of 1,000. Okay, so going back to the dictionary, all I'm going to do is write out a little dictionary just to kind of give you the flavor. I'm not really going to prove or derive anything in the dictionary. Here's a little thing that I mentioned because I think it's sort of illustrative of how flat results. Sometimes we say flat sky results. Those are results derived pretending that the sphere that we observe the CMB on is a plane. Suppose you were to compute the real space variance, or another way to, this is just the square of t in real space, or another way to think about that is that we just saw is it's the correlation function evaluated at zero separation. So we did this. In the flat case, we derived this result that says that this is just the integral of the power spectrum. Or another way to write this is, another way that you might write this, I'll write it as the integral of dl times LCL over 2 pi. The same calculation can be done in the spherical case to compute the expectation value of t squared at some fixed point on the sky in terms of the power spectrum CL. And if you look up the appropriate special function identities involving the spherical harmonics, then you get this result. The sum of 2L plus 1 over 4 pi CL. The reason I'm writing this down is just to say that this is very nearly equal to this. What I've written here, so strictly speaking, on the full sky, the power spectrum is only defined at integer values, and you sum them with this particular weighting. But if you approximated that sum by this integral, they're almost the same thing. I mean, this what I've written here is just one way of discretizing this integral with a spacing of delta L equals 1. And so it's going to approximate the integral pretty closely, since the CMB power spectrum is a slowly varying thing that only changes on characteristic scales of delta L of 100 or so. So if you were to take the CMB power spectrum from one of these big codes and compute the exact variance, and then approximate it using this integral, the two answers would agree to like something like 1%. And generally speaking, like most of the time, that's true. That if you want to calculate something like this, and you just calculate the result pretending that the sphere is a plane, you get an answer that's usually accurate to like a few percent. It depends on exactly what you're doing. And so that's fine for just exploring things and understanding. It's actually not good enough for data analysis, because we can observe the CMB to much better than 1% nowadays. But for a first treatment of the subject, I think it's better to just not worry too much about these curved sky results and pretend that the sphere is a plane. And you'll generally get answers that are accurate to on the order of a few percent. I just thought it would be useful to present this table to make it clear what's actually going on here. Really, what I usually end up doing when I make the flat sky approximation is I end up approximating some sum over L, which comes out of special function identities involving spherical harmonics by some integral. Okay. So, and the other thing that you really do need to know is that the number of modes at a given L is 2L plus 1. That counting is actually very important. So that's all I'm going to say about spherical harmonics. Oh, wow. There is a time dilation effect where, like, standing at the blackboard, everything just goes much slower. I covered, like, maybe a fifth of what I thought I was going to cover today. Okay. So well, what happened? So that's all I have to say about random fields. I'm going to start the next topic. I'm going to talk about statistics. I want to talk about how you get from observations of a random field like the CMB to cosmological parameters. I want to start off with the following statement. What I really want to tell you about is something called the Fisher matrix. By my estimation, there are about 100 cosmology papers on the archive per year that are primarily concerned with computing something called a Fisher matrix. I think over half of the papers that I have written have used at some point, at some intermediate point, the calculation of a Fisher matrix. What is this matrix and why are cosmologists so obsessed with it? I'm going to tell you in the next couple of lectures. Because I kind of like the slow, systematic approach building things up. Like, I liked how we talked about random fields just starting from Gaussian random numbers in one variable. So I'm actually going to talk a little bit for maybe half a lecture or so just about statistics in general. It's a fun thing to talk about, and I think it's useful. I want to start with just by talking about statistics in general with the following simple example. Consider a biased coin with some unknown probability. Theta of heads. That I want to estimate. Suppose that I, in 100 flips, I flip it 100 times, 64 heads occur. So I can conclude that theta is 0.64 with some statistical error. The first question I want to ask is, what is the 95% confidence region on theta? What is that statistical error? So it's intuitively obvious that, for example, theta equals 0.2 is way too small to be consistent with this observation. Suppose that you told me that and I didn't agree. I think 0.2 is plausible. What calculation would you do to convince me that I'm wrong?
Could we start checking the variance? I have recorded all the flips that I have.
You do have recorded the sequence of all the flips that occur. Although in this example, the only thing that matters is the total number, not the order. Let's imagine that someone like really wants to argue about this. They say, I think it's plausible that the coin only has a 20% chance of coming up heads. And it's just a big coincidence that when you flipped it 100 times, you got 64. How would you argue with that person and convince them that they're wrong? I like that suggestion. What would you say that... Suppose that for some reason you couldn't repeat the experiment. One possibility maybe would be to simulate repeating the experiment by saying, well, if theta was 0.2, maybe I could just do a bunch of numerical experiments and see how likely it is that I get 64 heads. So that's one approach, would be to say, let's say that just concentrating on the specific value for now, you could say if the true theta were 0.2, what's the probability of 64 heads? This is something you could do on the computer with simulations. You could just simulate flips of a coin with head probability 0.2 do many simulated experiments and compute the number that had 64. In this simple example, we can write down a formula for it. So I'll write it down. Let's say the probability P let's write it this way. So the probability of getting exactly 64 heads is this. Every time I flip the coin, if I assume that the coin is biased with head probability 0.2, every time I flip it, I have a 0.2 probability of getting a head and a 0.8 probability of getting a tail. I'm asking about the probability of a sequence of events where this happened 64 times and this happened 36 times. This binomial coefficient is just counting the number of possible orderings. I could have had 64 H's followed by 36 T's, or some permutation thereof. There's some large number of possible orderings that I have to sum over. I actually want to modify this formula a little bit because, you know, if I'm having this argument, then it really makes a little more sense to compute the probability of having more than 64 heads. If, for example, there were, instead of 100 total flips, there were like 1 million flips and 640,000 heads had occurred, then the probability of getting that specific number, 640,000, is always going to be small, even if my theta is exactly right. So it really makes more sense if I'm asking whether a particular theta is consistent with the experiment to ask, well, what would be the probability of getting 64 heads or more? So I computed this. And I got 1.37 times 10 to the minus 21. So there you go. If the true theta were really 0.2, then the probability of getting 64 heads would be 1 part in 10 to the 21. So that's a proof that theta couldn't really be this small. Now, of course, we can turn this into turn this procedure into a way of figuring out the smallest possible plausible value. We just keep increasing the 0.2 until we get some reasonable probability. So let's compute this quantity. If I compute this number as a function of theta true, then I find that it rises. So at 0.2, it's very tiny. It's 10 to the minus 21. And then it rises. And I decided to cut it off when it reached 2.5%. That occurred when the probability was 0.538. So this is what I want to quote as being the smallest probability, the lower limit of the plausible range. If the bias coin really had this chance of being heads, then there's still a 2.5% chance that I would get 64 heads or more in this experiment. So that's small, but it's not negligibly small. So let's say this is the lower end of the plausible range. And of course, I can do the same thing from the other side. Now, when I come in from the other side, I should ask about the probability of getting 64 heads or fewer. So the function I'm about to show you, I like writing down the formal definitions just so it's like precisely specified what I'm doing. This function, p of theta, so it peaks at 0.64, of course. If I define the plausible range by where it crosses 2.5%, then I have 0.538 on this side and 0.734 on this side. So that's what's called the 95% confidence region. So in this toy example, we've invented, in the context of this toy example, what we've invented is something called frequentist statistics. Where confidence regions are always defined by the probability of getting a particular outcome as a statistical fluke. Another word for this type of probability is a p-value. So to analyze data, I ask, what is the probability of obtaining a particular result, the result that I actually obtained, as a statistical fluke, given a trial value of the parameters? And then I vary those parameters and compute that probability, compute that p-value. I say that a result is consistent with the data. I say that the parameters are consistent with the data if that probability is above some threshold, in this case, 2.5%. By the way, there's a little convention that, like in this case where I'm quoting a two-sided interval, where I quote the interval, it's the 95% confidence region means that the p-value is split on the two sides. So I have 2.5% down here and 2.5% down here. So there's also something called, another comment is that in this example was simple, so we could compute the p-value analytically. I mean, it's not that simple, actually. It's still kind of non-trivial. But in complicated examples, usually you can't find analytic formulas, and you just do Monte Carlo simulations. So you would just scan over parameters and say, for a particular choice of parameters, let me simulate the experiment a bunch of times and see what fraction of times I get a result as extreme as the experiment. And if that fraction is large enough, if it's above some threshold, like 2.5%, then I accept the parameters and put them into my confidence region. So there are statistical methods tend to fall into two classes. There's this frequentist type, where confidence regions or p-values take center stage. And they always represent the probability of getting a particular observed outcome as a statistical fluke. The other type of method is called Bayesian statistics. And I'll tell you about that next, but since we only have 5 minutes left, I won't start it right now. I'll do it.
I still don't understand why you call it 95% of the probability. What is it, 95 and not 96 or something?
Why is it not 97.5?
Yeah.
Yeah, this factor of 2, I think, is always confusing. It's sort of like, it's as if you want to say that 2.5%, you allow 2.5% down here and 2.5% up here for a total of 95%. It's just a definition. You just have to be clear about what the definition means. Sometimes this is called a two-sided, 95% two-sided confidence region. It really means that on each end I threshold it at 2.5%. If you're objecting that the definition is a little counterintuitive, I agree with you. It's a frequent source of confusion. Okay. Next time we'll talk more about statistics.